This is the BBC.
I'd said to Jeff, you don't think there's any chance that I might find a way back to Radio 1? And Jeff came back to me about 7 or 8 weeks later and said, I'm really sorry, Bob, but the reaction was, oh, what, Bob Harris is going to come in and say, wow, man, listen to the colours.
3, 2, 1.
Vintage.
Hello, this is Bob Harris. I do remember listening to Radio 1 right at the beginning because I was a massive fan of the Pirates. Radio London in particular was my pirate radio station, and you know, Tony Blackburn, Kenny Everett, John Peel, there was a core of fantastic broadcasters that emerged via Radio London that then came across to Radio 1 when Radio 1 launched in September 67. So I sort of followed them onto the network. They took me with them, if that's the right way of putting it. And I mean, Radio 1 then was, when it first started, sounded so different from what we'd come to expect from the Pirates, because there were no restrictions on the Pirates in any way. Whereas, of course, the first hurdle that they had to overcome in the early days was the restriction of needle time. And so the way that used to pan out with, you'd hear a cover of Strawberry Fields Forever, let's say, by the Northern Dance Orchestra, the NDO. So it was a very different thing, and it took a bit of adjusting to that problem they had of overcoming the needle time restrictions. But gradually, Radio 1 found its feet, obviously, and people like John Peel began to establish themselves. And that's then where I began to come in. I was a Peel protege because I'd moved to London in 66, and being such a massive fan of John's program at the time, The Perfume Garden, I wanted to get involved with radio and I wanted to be part of the music industry. But for a boy who's just come up from Northampton into the big city, you know, where do you start? So my route in was via journalism. I was one of the founding editors of Time Out magazine. And I had an ambition that I really wanted to meet John. I wanted to interview him. So Tony Elliott, whose idea Time Out was, who was my co-editor, as it were, or more, I was his co-editor. But anyway, I asked Tony to organise for me to meet up with John to do an interview with him. And I met John with Mark Bolan. The two of them were together. It was at the time that John was really strongly promoting Tyrannosaurus Rex. And the deal was that if you did an interview with John, you did an interview with him and Mark, because Mark was always with him. And so I met the two of them and we became really good friends, John and I and Mark and I. And John became something of a champion for me. He recognized the desire I had to be on the radio. I'd already started doing a few DJ gigs and John really liked what I was doing. So he introduced me to a producer called Jeff Griffin, because John was part of a little sort of enclave of interesting characters at Radio 1 at the time. Jeff Griffin, Bernie Andrews, John, a couple of the other DJs at that time, Pete Drummond. They're all in this little sort of enclave in Aeolian Hall in Bond Street. And John took me in and introduced me to Jeff Griffin. And I talked ideas with Jeff. Jeff then did a pilot with me, which Radio 1 put on hold for nearly 10 months. But finally, in 1970, John was taking a 4-week break. And what Jeff was doing at the time was John would be introducing the In Concert program, which went out on a Sunday evening, which was then repeated on the Wednesday. So what Jeff didn't want to do was repeat repeats, if that makes sense. So suddenly those 4 Wednesday programs came up on Sounds of the 70s, and I found myself absolutely from nowhere. I'd done no radio before, sitting in for my great hero, John Peel, on Radio 1. And I loved it so much, I can't even tell you the feeling I felt when I got into the studio. I wasn't nervous as such, because I'd visualized myself in this place for so many years before. And it was just an incredible feeling. I did those 4 shows. And then at the end of those 4 shows, you think, well, you know, you never know what's going to happen, if there's going to be any opportunity again. But a few weeks later, David Simons, who is doing the Monday program, resigned. And suddenly that show came up and the BBC offered me that show. So that's how it all got started. I think the key thing with Sounds of the 70s, it was a bit like, actually, what Old Grey Whistle Test was to Top of the Pops. I mean, I did it then 2 years after I started on Radio 1, I started presenting Whistle Test. And the philosophy of Whistle Test and the ethos of Sounds of the 70s were very, very similar, bearing in mind that prior to the release of Sgt. Pepper, everything was about the single. The singles charts were the dominant force in everybody's music life. And it was an incredibly exciting singles chart in the mid-60s. There were so many different types of music spilling into it. But once Sgt. Pepper was released, and already we'd had Pet Sounds, already now bands like Cream and Pink Floyd and Soft Machine were beginning to explore what you could do with longer form, that you didn't have to restrict yourself to a 2.5 or 3 minute single. So let's see where that process takes us. And there was a tipping point in 68 where album sales overtook single sales, and the album was now becoming the major force, late 60s, early 70s. So Sounds of the 70s was a strip of programs designed to reflect that. And each of the evenings were genre specific. So in other words, say Tuesday was Mike Harding, which isn't folk Mike Harding. This is the engineer Mike Harding who, you know, came through on air. Wednesday was, say, the repeat of the In Concert program. Thursday was Stuart Henry, quite experimental. And Friday was Alan Black with sort of jazz rock, which, you know, became fashionable at the time. The Monday program, which is what I inherited, I just walked into something that was tailor-made for me, because Monday was the show that explored more the singer-songwriters. So bearing in mind that as I came on air, Your Song had just been released by Elton John, Ride a White Swan had just come out from T-Rex, Joni Mitchell was just beginning to emerge, Carole King was coming next year. You know, you've got this unbelievable generation, Van Morrison, of, you know, of singer-songwriters. And partly that's what my program was designed to reflect. The other thing, crucially for me, was that when I sat in for John, Jeff said to me, I'd like you to bring in your favorite music, bring in all your favorite tracks. I want the program to reflect your personal taste, but I will show you how to put that together in a show, how to program build, in other words. So Jeff taught me the building blocks of program building. And everything that he taught me at that moment, I still apply to my program building to this day. He was a hard taskmaster, Jeff. I mean, he really was. But I learned, and they're skills that he taught me that I've valued ever since. So yeah, I had a free hand, play whatever I wanted to. And I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. Neil Young, Cinnamon Girl. That was the opening track on my first show. Typically, sessions from people like Free, Wishbone Ash. Wishbone Ash had their first ever broadcast on my first ever show. So we were, you know, very much connected, the two of us, in having our first go on Radio 1, 19th of August, 1970. So then it was really just stuff that I was picking up. There was a great record shop in Berwick Street in London called Musicland. They had all the imports there, the import albums. So I'd be tracing in there to find what I could, that I just liked. Bridge Over Troubled Water was coming out just as I started on air. The Only Living Boy in New York was always my favorite track from that. So, you know, when For the Roses came out, I was playing tracks from that, and Court and Spark by Joni Mitchell. And crucially, sort of early Van Morrison, I loved Astral Weeks. And I think the album that more or less coincided with my arrival on Radio 1 was St. Dominic's Preview, so Redwood Tree. I play Redwood Tree from that. And I loved an album by the Apple Tree Theatre from a couple of years previously called Playback. There was a track on that called You're the Biggest Thing in My Life. So, yeah, those would be some of the tracks that I'd been mixing together. But I also had the chance of playing, you know, old stuff that I liked. And, I was always a massive rock and roll fan. So I'd sluice in do Ain't Eddie or Ricky Nelson or Buddy Holly or the Everly Brothers or whatever. Artists, actually, that I continue to play to this day. So it was a really eclectic mix. I think that was the thing that I loved so much about it. Well, I didn't, although, as I say, the framework of the show sat within the singer-songwriter genre, I was given freedom to expand that to wherever I wanted it to go. So it was really, and having sort of chiseled that particular ledge on the cliff face, I got known for that. And that's been the case ever since. Whenever I do radio programs for the BBC, it's expected that I build those programs myself. And that precedent was set when I first started on Sounds of the 70s. Right at the very beginning, I think at my second program, I think it was, we had a session with Elton, with the band that he had with him at the time. They came into Maida Vale, and usually bands didn't arrive till 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So the setup would, the load in would happen before that. And then we'd probably spend up until 11 or 12 midnight recording four tracks. Very much as you would in a commercial radio studio, with the band playing more or less live. You're capturing live from the floor straight to tape. And then Jeff would maybe mix it a little bit before it went out on air. And then we'd split those four tracks up into two in the first hour, two in the second hour. And then there'd be a repeat of a previously broadcast session. So we'd have those four numbers as well. So within the program, there'd be eight session tracks from two different guests. And at the time, that was partly dictated to by needle time restriction. And again, it was so formative for me, because then the idea that a radio program is a gateway for new artists to give them some exposure on air, that just became part of the DNA of what I've done ever since. So live sessions and supporting new artists is what my, you know, the petrol in my engine has always been about. One of the main things about my arrival on Radio 1 was that, unlike most of the people who were now establishing themselves, I hadn't come from the Pirates, nor had I come from Radio Luxembourg. I was a BBC man. I'd come from nowhere straight onto Radio 1. So Radio 1 at that time was very keen to support me as much for that reason as any other, that I was now beginning to establish myself. I remember, I think it was the following year, there was a Melody Maker poll, and John was number one and I was number two. So it sort of seemed to happen for me very, very quickly. And that was a lot to do with the fact that Mark White, who was the controller at the time, Teddy Warwick, Jeff Griffin, the management structure at Radio 1 really supported what I was doing. But Derek Chinnery was much less enthusiastic about this whole idea of 20-minute progressive rock tracks going out at 10 o'clock at night. And once he came to a situation where he was able to have some influence over that, he just felt, right, Sounds of the 70s has come to its natural conclusion. And I think it was the end of 74. So I came off, effectively, I came off Radio 1 then. I went to Radio Luxembourg and then to local radio. And at that moment, anyway, my head had been turned by Whistle Test, because now I'm full time doing the Old Grey Whistle Test, and it's taking me to America regularly, and it's giving me all the opportunity to expose new music that I loved. So that was the sort of breakup at that point. And as we went into the 80s, at that particular time, there were few people less fashionable than me. You know, long-haired hippie in the middle of the 80s is not, you know, it was not the most obvious place to be. But there was an incredible and, for me, amazingly fortunate turnaround. I'd made friends with Roger Scott, who is a DJ I deeply admired on lots and lots of different levels. But Roger got very ill, and in fact, he died of cancer towards the end of 1989. I personally was devastated on from the radio point of view, because I thought that he was just about, at the time, just about the best thing on air.